This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
What I will share with you are sort of new ideas which I started developing after I published the book, since already in my book I was starting to think that what is really most anxiety producing today is a certain obsession in late capitalism that sort of goes with the saying, be yourself. Now, just recently when I was taking subway ride in London, during one ride I saw three advertisements which used this idea. So one university was advertising their new courses with the saying, become what you want to be. Then a music record is advertised with saying, I am who I am. Then a beer company is using the logo, be yourself. Now, when I saw at the airport one of the latest Cosmopolitan magazine, I also saw the title, become yourself, only a better one. Now, this logic of become yourself and be who you want to be actually, you know, dominates us, our contemporary ideology. The media is constantly pushing us into sort of be some kind of self-creators. Now, this question of who am I for myself is actually a very complicated one. For centuries, philosophers have been trying to figure it out, and you know that Descartes was trying to find a solution to this dilemma by famously proclaiming, I think, therefore, I am. However, any psychoanalyst thinking about this, of course, immediately has much more problems with this idea of, you know, rationally thinking of who we are, since we know that unconscious always undermines our rational perceptions and rational choices. Now, if on the one hand we have this obsession of become who you want to be, on the other hand, it appears that we live in society where we also face constant new kind of determinations. Genetic science seems to be convincing us that everything in our life is predetermined, and that even a simple choice, you know, whether one smokes or not, might be, you know, sort of genetically determined. We also have, you know, quite an enormous kind of move towards various forms of religion, when creationism seems to be on the rise. Now, when I was recently taking a trip through a desert in Egypt, being terribly afraid that the car will collapse and the driver was not really sort of capable of dealing with it, I became, you know, quite convinced that for the driver it was far less anxiety producing this trip, because he said everything is in the hands of Allah. Now, when I did a little bit of research about how religion looks at this problem of choice, I came across in Cambridge Library a book, that a Christian kind of theologian type of book, which was discussing that some are perceiving religion today as a kind of a shopping mall experience. You sort of take religions out and then you choose, you shift. Even, you know, daily newspapers are informing us which movie stars are shifting from Kabbalah to Buddhism or back. And it appears as if religion too is a choice. However, that book was complaining that some people, you know, that people are mistaken in thinking that religion is a choice. Christians should find solution to this tyranny of choice in the fact that, you know, God made already the first choice in creating the man, and in this context, devotion to God, you know, is sort of beyond the choice one makes. So if on the one hand we live in the world obsessed with choice, on the other hand we can also say that we live in the world obsessed with the idea of happiness. In one of my travels I bought a book entitled Happiness with a Trademark. It's a novel written by Will Ferguson, a Canadian writer, in which the writer describes a society which is truly becoming absolutely happy. Now, in this society of today's time, people discovered a tiny little self-help book. Whenever someone reads that book, they stop buying cosmetics, they stop going to designer clothes, they canceled the subscription to gym, and sooner or later they also put on the doors of their offices the sign "Gone fishing." They abandoned their jobs. As you can imagine, capitalism, you know, starts collapsing very soon. Now, when capitalism is in a real crisis, the CEOs and the editor of the publishing house decide to find the author of this book. Now, the idea is that the author is a monk, kind of an Indian guy who for 10 years meditated up in Himalaya and then came with his wisdom to the West. But at the end, we learn that the author is an American guy, a retired person, a recluse who realized that he had only a very short time to live and he wanted to earn some money to pass it on to his children. Now, at the end, when the guy is discovered, the capitalist and the editor of the publishing house convince him that he made a disaster with this book, which is why they convince him to write a sequel entitled How to Become Really Miserable. And, of course, you can imagine it became a bestseller, too. So, now, when I was thinking about this obsession with happiness, I looked up what Lacan said about this point. And his idea was that a lot of people come to analysis with the idea that maybe analyst is a happy man and that they will find some happiness going through analysis. And Lacan said, you know, it's a waste of time searching for the happy man. And it is true, he said, that we analysts sometimes promise happiness at times when happiness became a political factor. But his idea was that, you know, one should, you know, avoid search for happiness, for the ills that it brings. Now, if capitalism plays on this idea of happiness and, in a way, choice, on the other hand, we can say that in capitalism we have all kinds of, an increase of symptoms, anxieties, and so on. Now, Walter Benjamin already spoke about capitalism being a regime which functions as some kind of a religion, where market is perceived as God and anyone who does not believe in market as a heretic. His point was also in a little note that capitalism actually increases worries and the feelings of guilt. Although Benjamin had a very conflicting relationship towards psychoanalysis, I think that his point should be taken seriously. However, what kind of worries do really increase and what kind of feeling of guilt escalates in capitalism? That's sort of, in a way, the direction in which I'm going with my next book, tentatively entitled Tyranny of Choice, and I will just sort of summarize some of the dilemmas I'm dealing with. Now, if today we are in some way perceived to have choices in regard to everything in life, now, even a couple of decades ago, lots of things that we perceive now as choice was not perceived as choice, to have children or not, sexual orientation, being married or not, even today in some traditional societies, not a matter of choice. But more and more, the subject today is perceived as a self-creator, as someone who has total individual freedom to create himself, almost like a work of art, which, as we know already, Michel Foucault was talking about in his last works. Now, President Bush was reported to have said, "I know who I am and I want to become who I am." Now, if President Bush is sort of calm about this issue, a lot of other people are not. And that's why psychoanalysts are saying that nowadays more and more patients are coming to analysis with the demand, "I want to reinvent myself." Now, recently in the UK, in their Big Brother contest, a winner was a Portuguese transgender woman, Nadia Almada. This was a big surprise, since the voters are usually quite kind of conservative people. When Nadia Almada won, she said, "Finally, I'm recognized as a woman." Now, when people were sort of thinking why a transgender woman won this contest, the researchers realized that what attracted people to her is the idea that she actually made out of herself what she wanted to be, that she's sort of a self-made woman. Now, in this idea, of course, making oneself into someone that one wants to be, of course, one easily finds the logic of semblance. You know, going back to Benjamin, we can say that here, too, we have a figure of semblance that people actually are constantly making themselves into kind of a semblance of an ideal. And even if you look at the body, the shows on TV which show the transformations of the body with the help of plastic surgery, you see that at the end, sort of everyone looks the same, high cheekbones, and so on. Now, this the logic of self-creation and the kind of a Nike ideology of just do it, be yourself, is also linked to the idea of managing oneself. Everything in our life is supposed to be manageable. We are supposed to be in charge of how we, conduct our relationships, and even in charge of our emotions. I did a little search on Amazon.com, how should one deal with, and feeling like anger, and, anger is supposed to be something that one should be absolutely control of. So I found 95,000 books that deal with anger, and a quick look at the first title gave me the idea that one should manage the anger. One lives in a trap of anger. There is, overcoming anger, controlling anger. All these were the titles, and of course, anger is a choice. So, if even anger is a choice, we can, have the idea that pretty much, every other emotion or affect is supposed to be a choice. Now, if this we live in times in some way of kind of individualization being pushed to its limit, where we have a radical fetishization of the idea of autonomous self, on the other hand, it appears that the very choice seems to be more and more anxiety-producing and deeply dissatisfying. Existential philosopher and novelist Albert Camus nicely described how everything is a matter of choice in life when he posed the question, shall I kill myself or have a cup of coffee? Now, it is not simply that our existence is defined by choices we make in our lives. Our very existence itself is a matter of choice. And we know that in regard to anxiety, it was already Kierkegaard and after him Sartre pointing out that anxiety producing when we are standing at the edge of abyss is not the fact that we might fall, but that it is up to us, that we are free to push ourselves into abyss. It's the possibility of, throwing oneself into the abyss which creates the anxiety for the subject. Now, Sigmund Freud was also quite cynical about the idea of choice. Once his friend asked him for advice which woman he should marry. The friend was in love both with a woman and her mother. And Freud said, when it comes to big choices in life, like whom to marry, having children or not, one should just do it. One shouldn't think long and hard. But when it comes to small things in life, one should, contemplate and so on. One can imagine that Freud sort of knew that no matter how rationally we try to figure out a certain situation, our unconscious will always, undermine our rational decision or guide us in a path that we cannot control. Now, there is a lot of discussion today also about the deadlocks of choices. Consumer choice especially seems to be a theme of analysis. A book, Paradox of Choice, by Barry Schwartz, published 2 or 3 years ago, for example, figures out that, having too much choice is incredibly paralyzing for society. Supposedly, students at Ivy League school in America have to choose between 300 different courses in the first year. And, of course, consumer choice in every shop, is overwhelming. Now, Schwartz tries to figure out ways of self-binding. That's why he proposes at the end of his book that one should sort of limit oneself. And in a way, make choices non-reversible, be satisfied quicker, and so on. He tries to find various forms where a subject will put limits, himself in society where there are less and less outside limits. Now, when people are talking that there is, in a way, too much choice, they are in some way invoking also the problem that they have with what Lacanian psychoanalysis calls the big other. Now, those of you who are well versed in Lacanian psychoanalysis know that big other is something that sort of we live in. It's the culture, institutions, the written, unwritten set of rules, and especially language per se, everything, you know, the social and symbolic setting in which we are born. Now, Lacan makes a puzzling comment that the big other doesn't exist, but it nonetheless functions, which means that it doesn't exist as a coherent whole. The social symbolic setting is always marked by antagonism, it's non-whole. And however, our belief in it, our presupposition that there exists a big other, it's crucial for our self-perception. Now, the fact that big other does not exist makes our choosing so much more traumatic. Now, in some way, we are always choosing actually a big other. We are always inventing a symbolic structure which we presuppose will alleviate anxiety in front of abyss of choice. Now, the problem, however, is that the big other is always just one of our choices, our creation, our fantasy of its consistency is the our doing. Now, it appears that by always creating a perception of big other, we are creating also kind of a fiction of possibility of sort of not non-choosing, idea of being that if there is a consistent big other, also in a way, choice will be much less anxiety producing. In the anxiety book, I mentioned the little article from New York Times where people were perceiving that now that they have to choose which electricity provider they will have in America, that they feel incredibly anxious. And they are claiming that anxiety is linked to the fact that no one is in charge in society, that when it comes to choices like who is the electricity provider, people sort of don't want to be left alone, that they want someone else to decide. And on the other hand, conspiracy theories very quickly emerges when people have the feeling that they are asked to make choices, but actually corporations are already choosing for them. Now, there is a lot of debate today in psychoanalytic circles that something has changed in our perception of the big other, and that we are living in society all altered in the meaning that there are less and less traditional types of authorities, less and less also of kind of bearers of prohibitions, which is why some writers are writing books with the titles of, you know, limitless society, the subject without gravity. And French philosopher, already 10 years ago, Pierre Legendre is his name, pointed out that, you know, there might be quite a catastrophic thing when one does not have old type of social prohibitions. His idea was that what Lacan calls the names of the father, the social symbolic law, does not function anymore in today's society, which is why his, you know, point was that we're entering a society which might have quite difficult, you know, quite catastrophic experiences for the subject. Now, a lot of other psychoanalysts are also pointing out that there is a certain push to enjoyment, to jouissance in today's society, an endless, you know, especially from the side of marketing. Now, what does it mean when some are speaking that we are living in the limitless world? Of course, psychoanalysis speaks about limit as, you know, the way the subject undergoes symbolic castration, the way the subject is barred by language. Now, the agent of castration is always already language. The one who sort of passes the prohibition to the child, usually that's perceived as kind of the role of the father or mother, someone who sort of passes the symbolic prohibition, who introduces the no, has to be castrated himself, and castration only passes through the bearer of the castration. So the question is, truly, did something change so radically in society that people are less and less marked by social prohibitions, which is why some psychoanalysts also are, you know, opening quite pessimistic discussion whether in today's late capitalism one also finds an increase in psychosis. Now, in the early 70s, Jacques Lacan made a very short observation about capitalism and pointed out that there might exist something like a discourse of capitalism where the subject relates to the social field in such a way that he or she takes him or herself as a master. Now, the subject is not only perceived to be totally in charge of him or herself, the subject also perceives to have power to recuperate the loss of jouissance. In capitalism, therefore, subject becomes perceived as someone who has enormous power. Now, what does it mean that the subject is placed in the position of such an agent? First, it looks that this subject is free from subjection to his history or genealogy, and therefore free from all kinds of traditional signifying inscriptions. This appears to be subject, you know, who is free to choose not only objects that supposedly bring him or her satisfaction, but even more the direction of his or her life. In a way, this subject is perceived as a subject who chooses him or herself. Now, Lacan also points out that one finds in the discourse of capitalism rejection, or better, foreclosure of castration. Now, this foreclosure happens when society more and more functions without limits, and where therefore seems to be a constant push towards some kind of limitless jouissance. Now, this push to jouissance at all costs is especially visible in all kinds of addictions, from excessive consumption of alcohol, drugs, shopping, workaholism, and so on. Capitalism more and more transforms the proletarian slave into a free consumer. However, this limitless consumption paradoxically provokes the moment when the subject starts consuming him or herself. And we can observe this, you know, self-consumption with the increase, you know, of bulimia, anorexia, various forms of self-harm in today's society. Now, and we can also say that with this idea of the subject being, you know, totally free chooser of who he or she is, we also find an increase of anxiety. Now, one way to deal with anxiety becomes strong identification with the master. The latter, in a way, the master that we find in some way allows the subject to relinquish his or her doubt, to avoid choice and responsibility, and therefore in some way find a relief for his or her own existence. That's why at times of high anxiety, very often new type of masters emerge in, you know, form of new gurus, religious leader, any kind of new ad hoc authority. And nowadays, I would say, you know, the self-help industry, you know, is more and more replacing the traditional type of authorities. We have pretty much advice for everything going on in our life. And Frank Furedi, you know, nicely entitled one of his books, Paranoid Parenting, especially as parents, since we don't anymore identify with our parents or such traditional authorities to guide us, we are constantly, you know, searching for new type of masters. Furedi points nicely that when we as parents have problems with children, we go read the books. The books say, go to a specialist. You go to a specialist. Specialist says, go to the internet. The internet say, buy books. So you're sort of circulating between these things. And as a mother myself, I must say that even I occasionally sort of do this, you know, at the end, you know, realizing that it's the hardest thing is to be an authority to anyone and to, you know, make set some guidances. Now, French psychoanalyst Charles Melmoth, you know, pointed out that this change in our perception of the big other is related to the overwhelming assumption that the world is rationally organized and that that there is the idea of sort of rational choice guiding us. And his idea is that there is no space in this world of rational choice for the alterity of the other, or better, a space for there is no big other at all. And almost a decade ago, two other French psychoanalysts, Jacqueline Miller and Eric Laurent, in a way speculated also that, in a way, there is no big other in today's society. And however, that what replaced the more traditional forms of the big other is today kind of an obsession with ethical committees. Their idea was that to the deadlocks that science brings to our lives, we are trying to find an authority in sort of committees. And those of you who work in academia, you know that whenever we have a problem, we create a committee. We still have a problem, at least we have a committee, to paraphrase Brothers Marx. And in some way, you know, another French philosopher, Denis Robert Dufour, also, you know, claims that there is no big other in today's society, and especially in the postmodern society. His idea is that there is a radical change in the symbolic order. His point is that there is, you know, less and less a point, an ensemble to which the subject can address a demand, pose a question, present an objection. And, you know, similar to Miller and Laurent, he points that the world today functions, you know, full of semblance of the other. Now, following Benjamin's prediction that capitalism functions today as a new form of religion, we can also say that market does appear as a kind of, you know, new god, and that everyone opposed to it immediately is perceived as, in some way, outside this loop. Now, in conclusion of my introduction, I would like to point out, you know, something in regard to the pessimistic idea that we are living in the world where psychosis becomes, you know, much more on the rise. Now, in some, especially, you know, French psychoanalytic circles, now for some time has been a new debate about the so-called as if personality, the term invented by Helen Deutsch, which, you know, tries to describe a type of psychosis where we do not have a full-blown psychosis, but the subject has a psychotic structure. Some are calling this nowadays borderline. Others are using the term ordinary psychosis or white psychosis. Now, an example of this kind of personality would be my French psychoanalyst Alain Abelhauser gave me an example of one of his patients who, when he was young, he met a guy who was a law student, and he decided to be a law student himself. Finishing law school, he became a fantastic lawyer. Then he walked on the streets of Marseille and he met a sailor. That guy convinced him to become a sailor. He abandoned his practice, became a sailor. Then once in a port, another port, he met a businessman. He followed that guy, became a successful businessman. He married a very wealthy woman and entered psychoanalysis. Now, when he came to... my friend asked him, why did you come to analysis? And he said, my wife told me to do so. Now, you can imagine that he became a perfect patient. Now, what was interesting with this guy, it's not so interesting, you know, so it's very American to change career and so in some way, not so European, but in a way, what was interesting for the guy was there was no doubt, no, you know, kind of uncertainty. When he was changing careers, he literally abandoned and followed. And imitation and very strong identification are two important characteristics of this as-if personality. Lacan spoke about this in 56 when he pointed out that as-if personality creates all kinds of imaginary forms of compensation in some way, you know, it's very, you know, quick in following and identifying. We can say that a lot of people, you know, who do very quickly follow sects or gurus or leaders, you know, might very well fall into this category of as-if personality. However, are we truly living in a limitless world where, you know, there are such radical changes on the level of the subject? I think it would be too pessimistic to conclude to the fact that something so radical has changed on the side of the way the subject relates to the social symbolic order. Of course, we have, you know, evidence for the kind of increasing plasticity in forms of identification. We play with identities on internet. We are constantly, in a way, do change gender, sexual orientation, and so on. And matters of religion and so on appear more and more as a matter of choice. There is increasing, you know, feeling of guilt, even to sort of, let's say, accept aging. One has to constantly, in a way, live in the moment, just perform, you know, something in the moment, and in a way, not subscribe oneself into kind of a generational line. Now, however, I would say that it would be too pessimistic to claim that our society have become, you know, so radically altered that psychosis is on such enormous rise. That's why I do not think that we are falling in kind of a society determined by psychosis. I do agree, however, that we are, you know, living in a world where especially media has an enormous influence on the people, and the perception of self-made man is sort of like a radicalized capitalist version of self-made man. You probably know that Edward Bernays, the nephew of Sigmund Freud, was called the father of spin, and he was in a way one of the inventor of the ideas of choice, especially introducing women to smoking. For him was an idea of freedom of choice. Now, some psychoanalysts are therefore concluding that, you know, in the time of late capitalism, we also do not have the possibility for emotional attachment or for love, or especially for some kind of a sublime love. And that sexual identification, in a way, becomes more and more difficult, which is why bisexuality seems to be on the rise. Sexuality appears to be, in some cases, you know, more and more a question of competitive rivalry and consummation, and less a possibility to find some kind of a stable object. More a matter of seduction and narcissism than long-term bond. Now, if we can observe these changes, nonetheless, you know, why am I not so pessimistic? You know, on the other hand, I would say another change that one can observe on the plane of sexuality is, of course, this push to enjoyment from the media and various forms of self-limitation that the subject introduces, you know, to him or herself. I was struck when I read on the internet that Princeton students now formed a celibacy club, which, you know, in the 70s, 80s would be unthought of. Or when I read that the famous John Gray, author of Mars and Venus book, which is like a Bible for young people today, is now writing articles under the title, "Why Did My Grandmother Have More Sex Than I Do?" Now, I would say that, of course, you know, we can see that nowadays, you know, with the less of limits coming from society or authority, the subject is introducing new limits to him or herself, especially on the plane of sexuality. Now, to conclude, I would say that when the subject, in a way, deals, you know, with problems of castration, he or she, in some way, deals with a lot of dissatisfaction. Today, it does seem to be that we are, however, observing an increase of frustration. And in a way, not so much simply dissatisfaction, but in some kind of a way frustration, which of course is linked to the subject's problem with jouissance. Now, Jean-Pierre Lebrun, French psychoanalyst, thinks that the will to jouissance today dominates social field, and brotherly solidarity of proletarians in a way is more and more replaced with competitive rivalry, which is why there is also an increase of social hate. We can say that this increase, you know, of racism, you know, nationalism, of course, has been on the rise for quite some time. Now, but, you know, why do I think that such a bleak future, you know, should not be sort of, let's say, our pessimism? Instead of overemphasizing the lack of prohibition in today's society, I would rather point out that the nature of prohibition has changed. On the one hand, the subject more and more searches for new forms of enjoyment and is under constant pressure to consume, which often does lead us to self-consumption. But on the other hand, the subject desperately searches for new forms of social limits. So self-prohibition doors, in a way, opens doors for new forms of despair. And with the lack of traditional authorities, the subject, in a way, does not seem to be coming closer to an idea of happiness. He or she desperately then searches for new authorities. So that, which is why a visit to any bookstore, you know, shows us that self-help books have been absolutely on the rise. I'm always observing how philosophy is shrinking and self-help is sort of expanding, taking usually the same space, you know. And, you know, which is why also all the advice on the internet is absolutely on the rise. And, you know, sometimes I'm doing this joking things, you know, the idea is that you have to love yourself. And I did search how to love yourself on Amazon.com, and I found 139,000 books how to love yourself and many manuals how you step to step start loving yourself. And then, you know, I did research a little bit on Google, how, you know, the idea was that you have to become yourself, how to become yourself. And I saw that you can buy for $20 a report, insight into the real you. So, you know, pretty much all kinds of authorities are emerging, which are telling us, you know, who we are. Now, dependence on this advice culture in a way shows that the subject still needs recourse to the big other. No matter how much, you know, the nature of big other has changed, there are constantly new forms emerging which are replacing the old types of big other. Now, although Walter Benjamin predicted that worries would become over-consuming in capitalism, he also made a puzzling remark that the concept of progress must be grounded in the idea of catastrophe. Now, what is catastrophe, he said. What is catastrophe is that things are as they are. Yeah, and if nothing changes, that's really, you know, a catastrophe. Now, maybe this gloomy prediction that we are entering into a society dominated by psychosis in a way expresses this paradoxical enjoyment in catastrophes. Now, it's the biggest catastrophe of today's society in a way that not that much has changed in the nature of people's worries. However, we do feel, every generation does feel, that in a way they have to surpass their predecessors in their suffering. Thank you.
I want to start by thanking Aaron and Jean-Michel for organizing this and for inviting me, and also for sustaining this incredible venue, which has done so much in a very short time. It's really a great thing to have. I just was making a few notes while Renata was talking, and I was thinking about four words. So maybe I'll just try to say something about them. The first is capitalism. And maybe I would just start by remembering that Freud had two theories of anxiety. The early theory was that anxiety was the result of an accumulation of sexual tension in the body, which had not been released through orgasm and somehow built up in the body and led to anxiety, which meant, of course, that anxiety could not be treated by psychoanalysis. Right? It could be treated by behavior modification, but not by psychoanalysis, because it had nothing to do with a repressed memory. It had to do with a purely physiological accumulation of tension. Right? And then in the second theory, when he began to say that the ego is the seat of anxiety, then anxiety could become a properly psychoanalytic phenomenon, because now anxiety could be transformed symbolically, put into play in relation to the ego's defenses, felt as a kind of threat to the ego, so that anxiety would be related to phobia and to other kinds of psychic phenomena rather than a purely physiological accumulation of tension. And it's in relation to that second theory that Freud goes on to distinguish the distinctions between realistic anxiety, which is the anxiety that one ought to properly feel when something's genuinely threatening, which is not really a psychoanalytic problem at all, it's a proper response. And then on the other hand, automatic anxiety and signal anxiety, which are neurotic forms of anxiety. And I was thinking about this because I was looking recently at some of Lacan's early work, and when he talks in the beginning about the ego, the first formation of the ego in the mirror stage, and the imaginary body, he seems to say that part of the child's, the real of the child's body, is not represented by the ego, is not part of the ego's self-construction. And that when the real of the drives, this is in the way that Lacan puts it in his very early work, the instinct, he even uses this language in the beginning, presents itself to the child, if it doesn't correspond to what the imaginary formation of the ego has been, that jouissance, that early drive energy, will be experienced as a threat. Not, of course, a threat to the organism, because it presents no biological threat, but as a threat to the ego. so that the first anxiety could come from inside the body. And it's only later, when the child goes into the stage of what he calls in the mirror stage and in early work, transitivism, a sort of rivalry with the other child, it's in that later stage that desire first emerges for Lacan. So that the child first experiences its desire in relation to the alter ego. That is to say, when the other child has a toy, suddenly I feel my lack, and I want your toy, right? And I'll scream until I get it, and then I'm satisfied. And it's the ego making its demand now, right? And so, when Renata was talking about capitalism, I thought, what about demand, supply and demand, and the ego's relation to the object in demand? And of course, one of the interesting things that Lacan does with Freud's theory is that he is not content with the ego and its defenses, and the language of the ego and its defenses. Really, Lacan goes on to make a distinction between the ego and the subject. In a fairly strict, sort of simplified sense, we could say that everything that comes from the ego is a demand, and that the ego as such is incompatible with desire. So that every demand, and maybe this is some resonance with the remarks Renata was making on capitalism, that every demand would in some way be at odds with the desire of the subject, with the possibility of the subject assuming his or her desire. Because every demand, to go back to Lacan's early formulations, every demand is haunted by a kind of emptiness, right? Every object of demand that can be taken, you buy your Volvo and then your BMW and then you have your Hummer and then you want to have an airplane for yourself, right? Because every object is lacking. And it's that lack which, for the ego making its demand, is first experienced as anxiety. And there's a kind of threshold of anxiety that has to be crossed for the desire of the subject to emerge. And maybe that in some way provides a kind of early Lacanian formulation for a background on capitalism. I would also say that in terms of Freud's vocabulary, the distinctions between realistic anxiety, automatic anxiety, and signal anxiety, Lacan says something very interesting about signal anxiety. He says it's a signal, but not the signal of a danger to the ego, which is how all the post-Freudians have interpreted Freud. It's not a signal that shows that the ego is in danger. It's a signal given that the subject is on the verge of emerging, that the desire of the subject is on the verge of emerging. And that emergence of desire presents the subject with anxiety that has to be, somehow the threshold of anxiety has to be crossed. So the signal, Lacan says, is a signal not to the ego, but of the subject. And it's for this reason, I think, that he says that anxiety is not a symptom. Very much in contradiction with what the psychiatric, especially psychopharmaceutical dimension of contemporary sort of analysis would like us to think, that anxiety is somehow a symptom that needs to be medicated. In fact, it's the very opposite for Lacan. He says it's a signal on behalf of the subject as distinct from the ego. So that's on capitalism. Then I thought also of the question of happiness, the term happiness, and the demand for happiness. Because Renata said that the demand for happiness produces guilt, which I think is right, and has some relation to the superego, this command of enjoyment and so on. But I was also thinking maybe about Freud's early position, which Lacan very fruitfully, I think, goes back to the first theory. Everyone says this is not the proper psychoanalytic theory. We need we need anxiety to be in have its seat in the ego. But Lacan, in interesting ways, goes back to the imaginary body and jouissance, the body being filled with phallic jouissance as a form of anxiety. So he makes a very, very fruitful use of recovering Freud's early theory of anxiety. And maybe we could say in some way that the production of guilt, the demand for happiness as a production of guilt, is a kind of jouissance in the body. But Freud says that, actually, if you look at the early theory more carefully, it's not purely physiological tension, right? Freud says that libidinal tension accumulates in the body and it is transformed into anxiety. Right? So anxiety itself, the phenomenon of anxiety in early Freud, is not the libidinal tension itself, which itself is purely a charge of energy. It's rather the way in which that bodily energy is transformed into anxiety. And in fact, it becomes clear that even in the early papers, in the letters to Fleece and so on, that anxiety can, that this energy can also be transformed into other phenomena. For example, guilt, or depression, or melancholia. So that the destiny of this libidinal tension could be, and maybe of the demand for happiness, could have guilt as a consequence and maybe other kinds of consequences as well, or other possibilities of transformation, some of which in fact you went on to discuss. And then third, I thought about religion, the remarks on religion, and they made me remember the painting that Lacan discusses in Television, in the English edition of Television. It's not in the French edition, but it was put in these additional papers collected in the English edition of the Caravaggio painting of the Sacrifice of Isaac, in which Lacan seems to argue, it's not very clear in the text, but he seems to be suggesting that this painting captures the very moment when Abraham is about to sacrifice his son, and the angel comes down and holds back Abraham's hand. The angel, you see the angel's hand on the hand of Abraham. And with his other hand, the angel is pointing to the ram, who will be a substitute. And Lacan seems to say that this is the very moment of a transformation in the subject's relation to the big other. That in the first case, the big other is the other of absolute devouring jouissance. Like the other who will demand everything of you, who will demand your absolute sacrifice. And I was thinking of what you said about the taxi ride in Egypt, where the taxi driver isn't so worried because, after all, it's all in the hands of Allah. But after the moment when the angel stops the act of sacrifice, then, in effect, God is saying to Abraham, satisfying my jouissance is none of your business. Right? God's lack is not for you to be concerned with. You go on and figure out what you have to do with your people and leave my lack to be. Right? So it's no longer Abraham's job to throw his son on the altar of the divine fire to fill the lack in the big other. Now the new relation with the big other is such that the other is barred, the other is lacking, which in turn means that now Abraham can assume his own lack and go on, that is, to pursue his desire in relationship to his historical destiny with his people, and not consuming his life in the sacrificial act. And Kant says something very similar to this in his remarks on the sublime. You know, he says something that's very close to Freud's distinction between fear and anxiety. He says that there are two ways of relating to religion, one of which is prostration, supplication, bowing down, and being in a state of fear that at any moment the big other could terminate your life, which Kant says is not genuine religion. It's only the man who can stand upright, Kant says, with a proper respect for his own freedom. It's only such a man who can then have a relationship to God that we call religion, rather than prostration and self-abjection. Which in a way means that for Kant, the big other has to be lacking in some way. So I was thinking of that when you were speaking about religion, and in some ways about this remark you made about Kierkegaard and standing on the edge of the cliff and the choice not to throw yourself into the abyss. And then lastly, choice and choosing not to throw yourself into the abyss. And the kind of choice that consumer society seems to instill in us or provoke in us or oblige us to pursue. And I thought maybe it would be interesting to develop, if there were time, some questions about some of the things that Heidegger says in Being in Time about choosing one's death, which is precisely the opposite of consumer choice, right? In a way, we could say consumer choice, capitalism, which is an installation of the demand of the ego, the ego's demand for happiness, is the very opposite of what Heidegger opens up when he talks about choosing one's death. Choosing one's death is choosing being toward death means making a choice in the face of anxiety, right? And it's opposed in Being in Time to running away in fear. Like, fear and anxiety and Being in Time have precisely that distinction, that fear is that which makes one run away from oneself, run away from one's fate, run away from one's choice, one's assumption of anxiety and being toward death, and turn away in fear toward Das Man, toward the everyone, toward the no one, toward the anonymous everyone of doing what one is supposed to do, which is what the choices of the television and so on and so on. And maybe those remarks on choosing and decision and choice could be even extended into some of the things that Derrida wrote about decision and justice and ethics as a choice which is an impossible choice, right? A choice which is a kind of not a logical choice, not a rational choice, not a choice which can be calculated absolutely in accordance with the demands of rational choice theory, let's say, or other kinds of ethical laws that one would choose in accordance with that law, but rather is a choice that is on the verge, Derrida often said, of madness, of a kind of madness, of a kind of a relinquishing of one's self-mastery. And that choice as an ethical choice might then be in turn related to some of the things that Lacan said later in his work on the act, the notion of the act. Maybe that's enough.
Thank you very much.
Yes, I would like to return a little to the idea of maybe the promise of happiness, the kind of set up that perhaps the psychoanalytic situation could entail, because someone may go to see an analyst because he or she is unhappy and hope that through talk therapy that unhappiness will be resolved. And happiness in the American context and in the history of psychoanalysis have been linked, if we think that already in the early 50s the National Commission on Mental Health was discussing as the main issue to be resolved whether or not the American people were happy. So we could maybe see there, has psychoanalysis anything to say about happiness? Is this a false promise when we recall that Freud proposes at the end of analysis to restore common unhappiness or ordinary unhappiness and help the patients to get rid of neurotic misery. So we exchange misery for unhappiness, and that would be considered a successful cure. So with that context in mind, I would like to also mention this idea of anxiety, which is a very helpful tool in analytic practice, because as Lacan says, and he devoted to anxiety a full seminar, and it's often one criticism raised against Lacanian psychoanalysis that it leaves affects aside, that true psychoanalysis should take into account feelings. And anxiety is a pivotal affect of the analytic treatment, and is something that has to be always taken into account, the analysant's anxiety, the analyst's anxiety, because some truth will emerge through anxiety, and what we could find out through anxiety when anxiety arises is because something about the object cause of desire is seen. We can have an example. A dream goes far up to a certain point. When that threshold of anxiety is past, we see a dream becoming a nightmare. So we see that anxiety reveals something that often is concealed. And in that sense of what can we learn from anxiety, what truth could we reveal, I was thinking of this issue of choice. Are we maybe in need of distinguishing between unconscious choice and conscious choice, between objects cause of desire, objects of desire, and objects of enjoyment? Because I was thinking of a common banalization of choice. When unconscious choices, namely sexual position, am I straight, am I bisexual, it would become presented in popular culture as choices that they're equivalent to moving to the suburbs, eating vegetarian. When these choices, if we think in terms of Freud's idea of overdetermination, are they truly choices, would be one possible question. Can we really choose when, if we think that we have at times three generations preparing a subject inscription in a family romance, that it may be a place for that person who will happen to be born in that place in the family, already awaiting, that are somehow these overdeterminations are perhaps beyond choice, and maybe part of the work of analysis has to do with the real implications of things we cannot choose. And taking into account what we are talking about, unconscious, that maybe is often foreclosed in popular production or in our culture today, I was thinking of the example you were mentioning, psychosis. And psychosis is a psychic structure that is extremely revealing. And what came to mind was a phrase by Lacan that says that the psychotic is a martyr of the unconscious, that is somehow a witness. So it's exposing something about the unconscious and also about the other. Because when you were mentioning, Renata, that there is more psychosis, what I was thinking is that the psychotic not only believes in the other, believes that the other enjoys him or her. And I was thinking of Schreber, who would try to go to the bathroom, and if the bathroom happened to be occupied, he would think that it was God playing tricks on him and enjoying the fact that he was preventing from going to the bathroom when he needed to. So there is this creation, as you were saying, of an authority figure that has a specific consistency that we can contrast with the happy uncertainty, that would be the only happiness, and a neurotic would be entitled to. And in that sense, also the idea of, once more, we think of the psychotic, the other enjoying, and whether or not, if we think in psychosis, desire is very hard to negotiate. And how, when you were mentioning that in late capitalism, there is this commandment to enjoy. And what I was thinking is that often we hear that we don't enjoy enough, we shouldn't enjoy more, and that there is something in terms of enjoyment that we could contrast with the arbitrariness of desire, that is one of the things that causes anxiety. One of the elements that causes anxiety is that the other may be completely arbitrary. The child may experience the presence absence of the mother without any apparent logic, and will create a kind of logic to this presence absence, and the absence will give to presence its consistency. And I was thinking in terms of jouissance and a desire, that when we think in terms of jouissance, we have a relationship of the subject with an object that in late capitalistic discourse is commodified and can be exchanged, whereas the object of desire is an object that resists commodification because it has no exchange value, only for the person whose peculiarity of desire that object will have a value that will also be a very temporary value, because the metonymic movement of desire will make that the objects will constantly be replaced in a different kind of logic that we will see in the replacement of objects of jouissance. And I was reminded, I think a year ago, precisely since we had Valentine's Day very recently, there was this campaign by Gap, the big poster saying, love your shoes. It wasn't Valentine's Day anymore about some sort of romantic rapport, but rather a relationship of jouissance between someone and his or her shoes. And with that, maybe move on.
Well, just say a few words, and we hope to open the discussion to the public. But perhaps starting from the book's cover, which I show here. I don't know whether you can see it, but you have Prozac pills on the cover. And I was hearing Renata and the two responses thinking of both the untimeliness and the timeliness of the discussion, because indeed when we think of anxiety, we think Prozac, pharmaceutical medication, whatever, it's a problem that can be fixed. It's not really a problem anymore. And there is this untimeliness in the sense that when we think of, you know, terms like the age of anxiety, Auden, this calls up the 50s, existentialism, Sartre, Camus, the absurd, things we have, I think, grown out of, in a sense. But maybe we need to go back to certain issues there with a different vocabulary, and this is the vocabulary that we're trying to discuss, elaborate here. In that sense, it's not so much that anxiety would have disappeared to be perhaps replaced by anger, as Renata suggested, as maybe this the fact that what seems to be offered as a solution is this legal addiction, that is, you can find your own medication, and if Xanax is not good for you, well, you know, uppers and downers and so on, which reminded me of the beautiful book by Nestor Bronstein on jouissance and addiction, in which he showed that in his experience as a clinician with addiction, what mattered for addicts was not really the happiness, the high, but the down, the moment when the addict experienced the lack, which sends us back to what is for Lacan a key insight, and I'd like to ask Renata whether she still thinks it's a useful insight, that is that anxiety is not created by lack, but by the lack of a lack. And so, indeed, an addict who is lacking in lack experiences that somehow, which sends me to my second question. This has to do with sexual activity. Is there less sexual activity because there is more anxiety or less anxiety? In the seminar, Lacan mentioned the fact that, after all, sadism, masochism, these perversions are connected with the anxiety-producing situation in which pain, violence is inflicted in order to create some kind of enjoyment. Same way, he mentions the dreams of failure and all those experiences of people who have to finish their work or late and so on, and can experience something like an orgasmic bliss as a surprise. So is that something that is still here today, or just in our nightmares, or something that has changed? In a way, what I'm asking is this, about this change, historical change, perhaps in the way anxiety seems to be the sort of borderland between jouissance and the excessive jouissance that is requested more and more of us in late capitalism, and desire, a desire whose horror we fail to recognize. Might I want to say a few things, or we can open it to...
We can open it if...
We can.
Yeah, it's fine.
Maybe we can open to the public if you have questions, but also it can be questions.
Yes.
Renata, to my book.
Well, I have one. I want to of relevance to the human condition in one capitalist. But as I listen, every method that gave evidence of the suffering by all of these groups, and every piece of evidence that was suffering, comes out of the experience of the upper middle class. And the only thing that gave direct evidence of the existence of poverty in late capitalism was John Michel's mention in Michel's introduction of Patricia's introduction of Puerto Rican neighborhood in North Philadelphia. I want to be convinced of the universality of what's being said, but in fact, the evidence and the methods don't give any acknowledgement of another slice of humanity, which is in fact the overwhelming slice. Am I clear about that question, or do you need me to get back to the things? The corollary to my remarks are, to what extent is there a danger that the talk about the excess of freedom, the seemingly endless abundance of choice, that it's not the lack, but the lack of a lack, helps to support projects that don't extend freedom in the political and economic sense?
Okay, I'm happy to answer you. Poverty is a very, very important issue, and in the anxiety book I did when I wrote on late capitalism, I looked at one phenomenon, which is that in the last couple of years there were so many books published where a middle class or upper middle class writer for half a year becomes poor. Mm-hmm. You know, that Barbara Ehrenreich phenomenon has been repeated. I bought at least 5 other books very similar, and actually I read them with shock. I was shocked first that, with the exception of one British woman, Toynbee, I think is her name, there was absolutely no political, actually, tone to the books. It was about an experience. Okay, we live in the reality type of show, we have to experience, so someone decides to experience. Okay, the tiny political theme was, you know, with some books pointing out that the Clinton ideology, for example, replacing welfare with workfare cannot work. Even if you work 80 hours per week, you cannot support yourself as a proletarian. Now, but for me, the crucial thing was a certain feeling of guilt that nowadays exists in regard to poverty, especially in Britain. America has been in a way much more into that self made man ideology for longer, but Britain, with a strong ideology of proletarian and sort of cohesive proletarian sort of movement, nowadays is very much following this idea. You are responsible, it's your choice. In a way, poverty too is perceived, you know, in some strange way as your choice. And, you know, coming from former communist country, I can say in post-socialism, I was shocked to read, you know, in Time magazine that in Siberia, in Russia, they are building, you know, thousands of tennis courts. Why? Because the idea is that everyone has a choice to exit by becoming a new Anna Kournikova. You know, that will be sort of, it's the ticket, which is why parents are selling everything, you know, sending kids to tennis schools, you know, and the statistics shows it's almost impossible, you know, to make a success in this. And here I think that this ideology, you know, does work in this direction too. You should feel guilty for, you know, being poor, and, you know, in some strange way it has been your choice.
And going back to the issue of anxiety, I worked for 6 years in North Philadelphia with the Puerto Rican community, and there I noted a surprising clinical situation that we have here, Prozac in the cover, the population I work with did not like Prozac. They were not presenting as the main psychiatric symptom, depression, which is for which often Prozac is prescribed, but rather anxiety. Most people would complain of severe anxiety, for which they would request the prescription often of Xanax, which is a medication that produces a state of blissful oblivion and some kind of sleep state, and would not work. And one interesting issue to explore from at least clinical or extensional to sociological analysis is why a population with three generations of unemployment without any choice to leave the community, with at times having gone through the educational system, having a high school diploma but being illiterate in Spanish and English, that being in an impossibility of traversing the invisible barriers of the barrio, would experience anxiety, and in severe cases of anxiety, that could maybe, if you want to make an extrapolation from the psychic sphere onto the social analysis and think that where this group, this population identified with an object, that is dropped from the fantasy of a society, and therefore anxiety could be a way of maybe bringing some truth into the scene in terms of the social position that this group occupies in terms of the socio-economical situation. But I will leave that to the sociologist, just maybe free association. But it is interesting as a point that you bring up, because the symptom in North Philadelphia is mostly anxiety, which is, I think, something to perhaps discuss tonight.
I don't really know what the question.
The question is, if you have a choice between maybe most people do not actually rack their brains trying to decide whether they should buy blueberries or strawberries or oranges and apples and pears and all those things. Even if they're not thinking about it consciously, just being presented with so many things, like so many options for buying your produce, that kind of changes the way you get affected.
Yeah, but you know, I think, you know, the desire, once, you know, when I visited Haiti, I remember, you know, actually with a group of psychoanalysts, Willy Apollon from Canada, and, you know, they were saying how happy people here are, You know, they actually looked happy. They had sort of everything, food and so on. It's very, very poor country. And, you know, how sort of happy they are. And my idea first was, you know, yes, they don't have electricity. In some way, desire, you know, escalates as soon as you get, in a way, electricity. Of course, you want, you know, one after another consumer objects. But I don't know really, you know, what the problem here is. Yes, you can say it's sort of an overwhelming thing, you know. But Lacan's point, which I think is interesting, that this consumer point makes a shift that society sort of starts functioning quicker and quicker. That's sort of one of his points also, that capitalism starts moving as a system faster and faster. And this movement, brings the point of self-consumption, which I think, you know, is something which really sort of bothers me, at least, you know, this transition of the choice actually becoming, you know, absolutely, you know, in a way horror for the subject of, you know, in a way, first idea having that you can choose yourself, but then actually more and more limiting yourself in establishing new and new prohibitions, becoming absolutely a self-prohibitor, and then, you know, the second part, what, you know, we are dealing here, especially you, in the practice, forms of, in a way, self-damage, self-consumption, which, you know, is kind of a fear. When you were talking, Jean-Michel, about anxiety, suddenly I also got this idea that Lacan very nicely speaks about anxiety related to a lot of things, and he points in the terms of sexuality. Orgasm is an anxiety which the subject usually quite well tolerates, you know. And it's very interesting, you know, also when you observe nowadays the drugs that are prescribed for anxiety, which are the same drugs that are prescribed for depression, you know, they used to be something that, you know, pretty much limits our sexual activity, but nowadays the same drugs are produced to elevate sexual activity. Those Prozac, for example, has been reissued now for women for PMS, and the idea is that it also increases the anxiety. Sexual possibility. And the other thing that Lacan points out, which we didn't point out, is that anxiety is very much linked to the problem of desire of the other, the desire of other being, that in a way horror, that you don't know actually what the other wants from you. And self-help industry appears to sort of try to appease this anxiety, trying to figure out ways how to read the desire of the other and, you know, give guidances for this. And when you're talking about masochism, I remembered, you know, another important point from Lacan, which is that a lot of forms of perversion are about, you know, provoking the anxiety of the other, especially sort of exhibitionism, you know, needs really to find the anxiety of the other. And, you know, of course, other forms of perversion too, playing on this kind of anxiety. When you asked about the lack of the lack, you know, I think that's a really important point, you know, and of course one of the answers we try to find how to envision, what does it mean that there is lack of the lack? We usually use the uncanny, try to figure out, you know, some kind of an emergence where the lack is missing. But in a social level, we can also say, you know, various forms of, you know, ideas of evil emerge, you know, as if, you know, they're really objects that stand in at the level of the social lack, from terrorists to bacteria. It appears, you know, that object that sort of stands it at the level of lack, you know, the lack in society being invisible, and then we, you know, constantly produce imaginary to sort of compensate for this, to give an idea of, you know, an image of the lack. We constantly produce, for example, figures of evil, which then become in a way anxiety producing.
Thank you.
But the first thing, poverty and middle class, I felt when, reading those books, Nickels and Diamonds and so on, that it is sort of an answer to the middle class anxiety, that this writing, let's go to see how the real, how poor really live, it, because the middle classes are sort of, in a way, anxious, the uncertainty in regard to jobs, the constant changing of jobs, and, especially in Europe with this absolute trauma about the retirement, the absolute insecurity now that, that hasn't been part of European perception of the old age. I think that this answer that the books give are sort, is sort of, they are so different. The poor are so different. You know, they are sort of, they look the same, they kind of act the same. They pretty much, they're very decent people. That all these books, I was just shocked. You know, they're honest, they're decent, but they're different from us. And one of the authors even says that they're so different. And then he says at the end of the book, he says, but, I have to say, I'm actually writing just about myself. I'm the man I'm selling. But then he says, but, who can I sell? I'm, selling that Shiver. That's the title, actually, of the book. About the new age of anxiety, when I was doing research of the book, I just also felt overwhelmed. There were so many books already then, about the new age of the new age. And then, just... So that all the previous two ages, after World War I and after World War II, the age of anxiety, they were dealing with very similar problems. That after some traumatic changes in society, people start rethinking, sort of themselves. And the problem with subjectivity sort of emerges. So it is after the, it's true in some way what Freud was already saying, that anxiety emerges after the trauma already ended. He uses twice this example of the train crash, that some people had an experienced train crash, and some of them will have nightmares. And his idea was that nightmares play out an anxiety that didn't exist before the event. That anxiety is sort of like, a buffer zone, a preparation. And if, because anxiety didn't exist, in nightmare you sort of recreate anxiety, sort of course, in a way, hoping that maybe you will prevent a repetition of the event. So anxiety is kind of often a preparation, which might alleviate trauma. And I think that in today's times, we have been, in the last decade, through a lot of types of violence, especially in my former country and so on, and pretty much globally now with wars, that are so, that, even, 15 years ago would be sort of unthought of, this escalation of violence, emergence of new kinds of wars, I think did create, of course, this idea that we are living in an age of anxiety. But I think that all this rethinking the subjectivity is, in a paradoxical way, quite similar that was going on after the World War I, especially. The writings about the place of the subject in capitalism. That was sort of their thinking, the writers who were writing then about the age of anxiety. We're thinking about that. The subject has lost rooting, it's homeless. They were speaking about the subject is homeless, is under pressure to consume and to make their private life consumption. That was the discussion after World War I, when the first age of anxiety emerged. That's why I'm sort of not thinking that we are that special, But that's what I said at the end of my talk, sort of that perception that every generation has to sort of suffer, in a special way, different than predecessors, is sort of like what Benjamin was talking about, that catastrophe actually is if nothing so much changes.
Another question.
Sort of with
maybe, I don't know, we can all answer to this, but maybe what you have in mind is Benjamin's idea of distraction, the distracted masses without subjectivity as an answer to late capitalism and a way of doing away with interiority and so on. And in that sense, indeed, you might argue that psychoanalysis keeps up the defunct, the already defunct subject. But I think, and this is what we all, I guess, believe, with the Lacanian or late Lacanian versions of psychoanalysis, what matters is really the distinction between the subject or the logic of the subject as something that can be calculable in a determination from the big other. And it's not the full subject, of course, of the old subjectivity. Or at least this is where I think Lacan really insisted upon something that he saw as a danger in Freudian psychoanalysis already. So this is, of course, a divided subject, divided by desire, divided from without, external to itself, and so on. Which implies, of course, a very complex discourse in order to talk about this, since you cannot even believe in, say, an anthropology of emotions, for instance. The subject, in that sense, is not defined by primary or any kind of emotion, but there are effects, not affects, in that sense. I don't know whether you want to.
I would just say, it seems to me your question really puts a lot of pressure on the question of what we mean by the subject. I think quite rightly that it's easy to imagine that somehow the notion of the subject keeps in place too easily, as you suggest, identity. But in fact, when Lacan talks about the subject, he often uses formulations that have to do with temporality and the coming into being of the subject and the devenir and the future. And of course, that future, as Renata's presentation really sort of circled around again and again and again, is not a free choice. So it's a complicated issue. It's not as if the subject can come into being in this sort of pseudo-Deleuzian way of becoming a fish, right? As Patricia says, the unconscious choice, for example, of sexual position is, there's a real inscription of the subject in the beginning, and coming to terms with one's own positioning in relation to the big other has to do with coming to terms with the way in which one has been determined. But the coming into being of the subject has to do with the possibilities of having some movement within that determination. And in that sense I think the subject cannot be made equivalent with any notion of identity. The subject as divided is not a kind of logical principle of non-self identity. It's a question of the temporalization of the subject as a coming into being, which, and I was hinting at this a little bit in the very end of my remarks when I talked about decision, the act, things that Derrida says under the rubric of responsibility, that the act is Lacan always says, is connected with sublimation and creation, destruction and creation. And in that sort of small margin, there's a possibility for a becoming that is at odds with identity.
Continuing to think of renewing collective action. And that's my
it is an important issue. I agree, but I think that, you know, there seems to be a convergence today of a Deleuzian discourse and of a late Lacanian discourse that I think would never say that Freud is only talking about the individual, for instance. It's a collective subject. I think this was clear when we were talking about poverty or ghettos and so on. You know, it's also an issue in the clinic if you reduce somehow individual symptoms to a class symptom, which is also another problem that goes in a different direction.
I think was already implicated in Renata's presentation about what kind of other are we talking about. If the subject is constantly relating to the other, and anxiety could be one compass to guide us in discovering the relationship of the subject to the other. This other is the representative of a fundamental important other, could be the mother, but also represents the social context, the discourse, language, culture. So I think we're working with the concept of subjectivity that is traversed by the social, and I think that's the interesting thing in we were talking about, for instance, symptoms of anxiety when in my clinical experience in North Philadelphia, that each individual case was somehow a metaphor for a social situation, but with the specificity of each person, his or her particular history, but also constantly traversed by a social historical discourse that exceeded the personal events of that subject. And I think that's, in a way, what makes very rich both Freud and Lacan's concept of subject, subjectivity, and what kind of phenomena will work in not only in a clinical situation that could then be extended to the social realm.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, let's say what in former Yugoslavia we have done as theorists at the time of communism, you know, with the help of psychoanalysis, try to figure out why people identify, or actually when they don't identify with the regime, exactly their disobedience in a way. Private disobedience, private disbelief actually helps the regime to be in power. That was sort of, in a way, easy. You know, it was much easier time when you had a certain kind of, let's say, the setting, social setting, the big other, if we loosely use that term, you know, for kind of a particular kind of communism functioned, which I think now with capitalism becomes far more difficult. And that, I think, it should be our task, in a way, to figure out, you know, sort of what's happening on the level of the social, and you know what's happening on the level of the subject, as you pointed out in your book. That's really fascinating, almost, you know, going really in the direction of Freud, malaise of civilization. You know, he pointed out that, you know, the subject malaise and the malaise of civilization always in some way go hand in hand, each influencing the other. That's crucial. But speaking about anxiety and choice and so on, I think one should not forget that one of the crucial points of psychoanalysis, Freud and Lacan, was, you know, the idea of freedom and choice being still on the side of the subject. Although they would speak about forced choice, but, you know, both speak about the choice of neurosis and, you know, falling in psychosis being a forced choice, which means that, you know, the subject has, you know, this, where is the subject, in a way, of the meaning also of the act, making an act, not simply subjected to, let's say, the society or the history. And I think that that element of the freedom, you know, is linked to anxiety, which, you know, both Kierkegaard, Sartre, and psychoanalysts are sort of from different directions thinking about.
Time for one last question.
What kind of symptoms result of the fact that we're told that we have choice?
I agree with your conclusion, you know, in a way that precisely this obsession with self-help books totally takes away the choice, you know, if the ideology on one hand is make yourself into what you want to be, pretty much this proliferation of books is pretty much like really new authorities exactly telling you how to do it, what to do it, seven step or whatever to success, and, you know, it's pretty much like a new Bible that for, you know, a majority of people nowadays.
I think we have to conclude. I'll just conclude by saying that take a look at this book. It is many things, but it is not a self-help book.
Thank you.